Understanding the Surface of Betelgeuse. James Webb's third observing cycle has been announced. Starship's upcoming third test, and the most massive pair of black holes ever seen. All this and more in this week's Space Bites. After Betelgeuse dimmed a couple of years ago, we've been fascinated about this mystery. Why did this enormous star suddenly dim from our perspective? It was significant. Like, you could go outside, and if you've looked at Betelgeuse, you looked at it, and it had dimmed tremendously. And then it came back. And so people were wondering, like, is this it? Is this when this star is going to finally explode? Nope. It was probably just due to some kind of dust cloud. But astronomers have been trying to understand and measure the surface of Betelgeuse, just try to learn more about what this star is doing. And one of the big surprising discoveries is that the star is rotating way too quickly compared to what it should theoretically be possible to do. Now, keep in mind, Betelgeuse is so big that if you plopped it in the solar system, it would expand about to the orbit of Jupiter. So when astronomers measured the surface of the star and tried to detect the rotation speed, they used one of the most powerful telescopes on Earth, the Atacama Large Millimeter Array. It's 66 separate telescopes in an interferometer, and they were able to measure the speed that one side of the star is moving towards us and the speed that the other half of the star is moving away from us. They can measure the Doppler shift of the two sides of the star as it turns, and they got 5 kilometers per second, which is just surprisingly big. But there's been this other theory that says, no, wait, it's not that the star is rotating, it's in fact that the star is boiling and bubbling so significantly that it mimics that it's rotating. And so astronomers went and performed a bunch of simulations where they took the observations of Betelgeuse and they said, could you explain this with giant convective cells on the surface of Betelgeuse that are just boiling and popping out into the surface? And like, keep in mind, you can have these convective cells on Betelgeuse that are like a third of the size of the star. Blows your mind. And they found that, yeah, you could have these convective cells where you've got material that is rising to the surface and then falling at about 30 kilometers per second. And when you look at all of the various observations that were made and you average it out, you could explain what appears to be the rotation of Betelgeuse by actually just its surface boiling and bubbling. So obviously more observations are necessary, but maybe this makes the star a little more normal for an incredibly abnormal star. James Webb's Cycle 3 is out. Now, last week, we mentioned briefly that James Webb Space Telescope's Cycle 3 observing run has been locked in. This is where thousands of astronomers have submitted their proposals to the Space Telescope Science Institute, and they have a council that looks through all of these proposals and narrows it down to what they think are the best uses of the James Webb time. They got about 6,000 proposals from astronomers around the world, and they were able to narrow that down to 253 approved proposals. And in that, they've set aside 5,000 hours of observing time, as well as 1,000 hours of parallel observing time. And the winners, there's 2,000 individual astronomers that were part of these 253 proposals coming from 41 different countries. And obviously, you're going to have the standard collection of things. You've got observing exoplanets, you've got asteroids, you've got looking back to the earliest times in the universe at galaxy formation, and then of course you've got these large galaxy surveys like JADES and SEERS. But one of the ones that I'm most excited about is the approval to Dr. David Kipping to observe exomoons. And I actually did an interview with David a couple of weeks ago, and he was talking about his proposal and how it was a long shot and it was a lot of time and he didn't think it was going to get accepted. But they made it. And so they've gotten more than a day of James Webb time to search for exomoons around one of the most interesting planetary candidates that they're looking at. So congratulations to David and the team. Definitely check out that interview if you want like a detailed understanding of exactly what it is that they're looking for and the clever trick they used to get this one across the finish line. See where Webb and Hubble are looking right now. Now, have you ever wondered what James Webb and the Hubble Space Telescope are up to at any moment? Well, now you can. NASA set up a new website where they give you just exact detailed information on what both of those telescopes are observing. You can go to either telescope, whichever one you want. You can see the exact designation of what it is that it's pointed at, what the program is. There's even a map of the sky. Now, it's not a map of what's being seen by Hubble or James Webb. It's a map that came from another survey of the sky, more of a low resolution version, but it gives you a sense if it's looking at a supernova remnant or a nebula or a galaxy or things like that. And then if you click on the observing details, you can see which instruments on the telescope are being used, what's the duration that they're going to be gathering data for, who the principal investigator is. Like, it's so much information. So you could almost watch this like a television, just watch as these two telescopes move from target to target. You can go forward in time and see what's coming next and then what's coming after that. So if you ever wanted more data about these telescopes, now's your chance. Starship's next flight attempt. All right, we've all been waiting. When will SpaceX Starship make its next attempt to fly to space? And we've got an official announcement from SpaceX. It's going to be March 14th, which is in about a week from when I'm recording this. Actually, it's exactly a week, which means that we're going to have to wait until they do their test to record Space Bites, and then we won't know all of the information. So we're going to have to release a video, and then people are going to give more information in the comments down below, and then we'll, anyway. So once again, the plan is to do a full stack launch. They're going to try to launch the SpaceX Starship on top of the Super Heavy. They're going to try to separate both spacecraft. Super Heavy is going to do a soft landing in the water relatively nearby. Starship is going to fly to space, and then it's going to make a soft water landing probably in the Indian Ocean. Now, in addition to just getting the basics of this mission complete, SpaceX has decided to make it a little more complicated, so they've added some bonus goals. They're going to try to open and close the payload doors on Starship. They're going to try to test propellant transfer inside. And of course, they're going to have to relight the Raptors while it's in space so that it can perform an atmospheric reentry. So, is this going to work? We'll keep you posted. Next week's episode, we'll know whether or not it worked. Of course, I'm going to try to gather up a bunch of my space friends and do analysis of this mission. But if you want to see the previous analysis with Scott Manley and Marcus House here on this channel, definitely check that out. Asteroids crashing into a white dwarf. Our sun is a main sequence star, and when it runs out of fuel in the core, it's going to shift to burning helium in the core, and that will cause it to blow it out to become a red giant. It will go through cycles of other burning in the core, and eventually it'll run out of fuel, it'll throw off all of its outer layers, and all that will remain is the white dwarf core, essentially the exposed core of the sun. Then it will just cool down to the background temperature of the universe over quadrillions of years. But you're probably wondering, what happens to us? What happens to the planets? And astronomers have actually found evidence of planets around white dwarf stars. They've also found evidence of the pollution of metals in the atmospheres of white dwarf stars. In other words, smashed up planets that crashed into the white dwarf. Up until now, that evidence has just been a general metalness in the atmosphere. That's so metal. But now astronomers have found a blob, a splat, a place where something, probably an asteroid the size of Vesta, which is about 500 kilometers across, crashed into the surface of a white dwarf star. It has now left this bug splat as it's orbiting around the white dwarf star. So what happens to us? Maybe that. Every week, we give you a chance to vote and tell us what you thought was the best, biggest, most important story of the week. And last week's most popular story was that James Webb detects reionization from dwarf galaxies. And I don't blame you. In fact, I probably ruined the vote there when I said, this is enormous news. Yeah. Anyway, I don't care. I don't mind making this biased. Now, after we post Space Bites, within about 24 hours, we will put up a new poll. We put it into the community tab on YouTube, but you can also just be scrolling YouTube and notice the poll and just take a second, click on it, vote, and we will gather up all of the votes and celebrate them here next week. Now, the best chance to see the poll is to be subscribed to the channel and then click on the notification bell. A robot surgeon on the International Space Station. Now, astronauts are the most skilled human beings on Earth, in my opinion. They have multiple degrees. They're test pilots. They're nice people. They're really amazing to spend time chatting with astronauts. But they can't do everything, and not every single mission to the International Space Station is going to include a skilled surgeon who can perform appendectomies or other emergency surgery while in space. And so to fix this gap in capability, NASA is testing out a surgical robot on the International Space Station. Now, this is teleoperated. So there was a surgeon on Earth who was working with the robot, and the robot had little knives on it, and it was cutting through elastic bands, which would mimic human tissue. And the surgeon had about a half second delay as they were providing commands before the robot was able to accomplish them and give feedback back to the surgeon. Surgeon was able to compensate for that and get to the point where he could actually perform the surgery. This is interesting with the International Space Station, but you can imagine when they go to the moon, to the Lunar Gateway, then this is going to become even more important. And then at that point, you've got about a 2 second delay for these commands to go before the surgeon gets that feedback. And still, that is theoretically doable. And so maybe in the future, if someone has to have their appendix removed, then a surgeon on Earth is going to be operating a surgical robot hundreds of thousands of kilometers away to actually perform the operation. How much oxygen is produced on Europa? The surface of Europa is covered in water ice, and the surface of that ice is being pelted by the trapped radiation that is around Jupiter. And what you get is, as these particles strike the surface of Europa, water is released into space, split up into oxygen and hydrogen. The hydrogen is very light, floats away from Europa, but it's believed that some of the oxygen goes into orbit, into this very thin, tenuous atmosphere that hangs out around Europa. And scientists wanted to know how much of this oxygen is being released from Europa. And more interestingly, is there a mechanism where this oxygen can make its way back down through the ice on Europa and maybe be able to reach the liquid water ocean underneath this icy crust? Previous estimates that there was about 1,000 kilograms per second being lost from Europa. Well, NASA's Juno spacecraft is in orbit, has done a bunch of observations of Europa, and it was able to track that, in fact, it's only about 12 kilograms per second of this oxygen is being released from the surface of Europa. And so this oxygen would then be in this tenuous atmosphere around Europa. Some of it would fall back down to the surface of the moon and then seep through the cracks that are probably on the surface of the world, and then go into these subsurface lakes that are maybe a few kilometers down below. And then maybe this water seeps from lake to lake down to the very ocean level, where it enriches the area with oxygen gas. And then that's something that the microbes in the area could then use for life. So I guess this is bad news for life. Less oxygen than they thought. Someone's still going to have to send a submarine to Europa. The LIFE telescope detects life on Earth. Now, we know about thousands of exoplanets, and now astronomers are starting to catalog the atmospheres of those exoplanets. And they're detecting molecules like water, carbon dioxide, methane, and so on. But that is still a tiny step towards knowing, is there life on that world? Are there biosignatures in the atmosphere of that planet that could tell you, yes, there is life there? So there are a couple of next generation telescopes in the works that hopefully will be able to answer this question. They are the Habitable Worlds Observatory, and there's the Large Interferometer for Exoplanets. Both of these telescopes really have one main job, which is to examine the surface of Earth like worlds orbiting around sun-like stars to measure their atmospheres and try to detect the presence of biosignatures. And so the researchers working on the proposal for the Large Interferometer for Exoplanets, the LIFE telescope, they asked themselves, well, if we took the telescope as we are planning and we saw the Earth, would we know if there's life there, say within about 30 light years from here? So they simulated what it would be like for the LIFE telescope to image Earth at this distance of 30 light years. And they assumed that they didn't have the right orientation. They could be looking at the poles or the equator, be going from day to night, day to night. And pretty quickly, they were able to find the various chemicals in the atmosphere, like water vapor, carbon dioxide, methane. And in fact, they figured they would be able to even detect the presence of liquid water on the surface of the world. And that they estimated with about 50 to 100 days of observing time, which, like, that's a lot, they would get to the point where they would be able to start seeing the biosignatures that were required to give them a hint that, yes, there is life on this planet. So theoretically, the next generation telescopes that are in the works planning today will allow us to be able to detect the presence of life on worlds that are within a few dozen light years of us. Now, if you want more information on this, I did a pretty great interview with the lead author of this study, Dr. Daniel Engerhausen, and he talked about the LIFE telescope and sort of what the capabilities are and a lot of really cool ideas about what it takes to try and find life on other planets orbiting other stars. The most massive black hole binaries ever found. Supermassive black holes are at the hearts of most galaxies. But how do you get a supermassive black hole? Only through the merger of less massive black holes. And astronomers have identified galaxies that are merging together, and the supermassive black holes that were at the hearts of those two galaxies are now starting to interact and go into orbit around each other. And now astronomers have found the closest pair that they've ever seen. They found a pair of black holes that are only 24 light years apart, and together their combined mass is, wait for this, 28 billion solar masses. When you think about Sag A star, which is only 4.3 million times the mass of the sun, and that these two black holes are 28 billion times the mass of the sun, it's mind-blowing. But there's a big outstanding problem in astronomy, which is known as the final parsec problem, where you have these two supermassive black holes that are orbiting around each other. They are so massive and distort space-time around them so thoroughly that it kicks out all of the other material, all the stars, all the gas, all the dust, and there's no more material in their vicinity that will cause these black holes to continue getting closer and closer together. And yet they do. I mean, we know that we have these supermassive black holes, so how do they do this? And this is still a giant mystery in astronomy. What gets black holes to the point for the final couple of light years they can actually merge together? So no answers, but still amazing observations of this gigantic binary black hole pair. Satellite observations of fossil fuel emissions. All right, thanks to satellites, we can track exactly what is happening in the atmosphere of planet Earth. And so scientists have been tracking the amount of greenhouse gas emissions that humanity has been putting into the atmosphere. Not surprisingly, greenhouse gas emissions are continuing to rise. They went up 1% from 2023 to 2022. In other words, we had our best year, our worst year in 2023. We added 36.8 billion metric tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, as well as an additional 4 billion that came from wildfires like we experienced here in Canada last year. So we're now up to 420 parts per million of carbon dioxide, up from 278 parts per million in 1750. So we did it. We hit 420. Where will we go next? I've mentioned this in the past. I write a weekly email newsletter, which I send out to about 70,000 people every week. It is completely free. There's no ads in it at all. And the stories that we're covering here on Space Bites are just a fraction of all of the stories. Like, I think we've got about 7 or 8 stories this week. Typically, there's about 40 stories that we cover in Universe Today. And the way this works is we release Space Bites, and then within a couple of hours, I will release the weekly email newsletter. I'm going to give you some examples, and maybe I'll do this every week, of the kinds of stories that didn't make the cut, like a plan to send drones to the moon that could fly around with propellant and map out the surface, or how long we could expect to wait for alien civilizations to attempt to communicate with us until they don't receive a response back from us, and observations from James Webb of an active galaxy just 430 million years after the Big Bang. So there's plenty more stories in the newsletter. I can't put them all into video form, but if you go to universetoday.com/newsletter and sign up, you can get this every Friday in your email box, totally free, no ads. I write it. Check it out. All right, I'm going to talk a little bit more about allocating time on the James Webb Space Telescope, but first I'd like to thank our patrons. A special thanks to Abe Kingston, Andrew Gross, Antonio Lofilara, David Giltinan, Dougie Stewart, Dustin Cable, Jeremy Mattern, Jordan Young, Josh Schultz, Mark Anstis, Paul Rohrbach, Stephen Krasaki, Stephen Fowler-Munley, and Vlad Shiplin, who support us at the Master of the Universe level, and all of our other supporters on Patreon. It was great to see the allocation time that was finally posted for James Webb Cycle 3. We watch these every time, and when I look through the list of the kinds of observations that are planned to be made, you sort of imagine, you know, I think about the best we know about certain objects, and I think, oh yeah, that would be amazing if James Webb would get time on that object, be able to observe it with more detail, with instruments, see it in the infrared, look through the gas and dust. And it was really interesting to kind of go through this process. Like, I really hope you watch that interview that I did with David Kipping, because he talks about what it was like to go through this whole process, multiple attempts of applying for time on Webb, and then finding out that you didn't make it and didn't make it, and having to fine tune the proposal to the point that it was exactly what the committee was looking for. And I don't think people realize, like, access to both Hubble and Webb is free, is available worldwide. That all you have to do is have a good proposal and you can get time on these telescopes. Amateurs have been able to collaborate and get time on these space telescopes. It really is cool to see these incredible, expensive instruments and yet are still made available to scientists everywhere on Earth. Cycle 3 is out. It's funny, one of the most popular videos that we've done was the Cycle 1 video that wrapped up in July 2023. Of course, we're collecting all of our stories for the Cycle 2 episode when that wraps up this summer, but it's going to be a monster. There's so much incredible work that's been done on James Webb this year. Of course, we will be bringing you up to date on all of the cool observations that go through Cycle 3 of James Webb. All right, that's it for the news this week. We'll see you next time.